This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Bill Moyers is often offered as proof that it's possible to produce popular TV programs that offer in-depth, reflective conversations. Before Moyers became a journalist, he studied at Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary and was ordained as a Baptist minister. Several of his programs over the years have reported on religion and its place in the lives of Americans. His new PBS series brings together Bible scholars, educators, novelists, and artists to discuss their interpretations of the book of Genesis. He chose Genesis because it's the source of the three great monotheistic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. The series begins Wednesday, October 16th, and continues over the next 9 subsequent Sunday evenings. Moyers also has a companion book called Genesis, A Living Conversation. The series was inspired by a Bible seminar in New York at the Jewish Theological Seminary. I asked Moyers what excited him about that seminar.
Well, the first thing that excited me was a little item in the New York Times that described it as the best conversation in town. And, of course, covering the world of ideas for television, that's what I wanted to go and hear. So I called Rabbi Burton Vysotsky up and asked him if I could come. He said, sure, come on. I went. What I found was a collection of biblical scholars, both Jewish and Christian, a film critic, a screenwriter, a poet, an editor, an essayist, and a novelist, and they were really making the most of it.
You described something that Rabbi Vysotsky said. You say he explains to newcomers that the communal study of the Bible can continue to provide us with a means for clarifying our ideas about the world around us and for linking them historically to a longstanding tradition. I like that way of putting it. Add to that for me. Tell me why you think it's important to talk about biblical interpretation on television.
Well, so much of the talk about religion over the last 20 years has been dominated by a politicized and polemical form of discussion. Sometimes I've thought that religion has just been reduced to another interest group like the National Rifle Association or the National Association of Manufacturers, or the AARP, and sometimes that talk has also reduced Moses and Jesus to lobbyists with Gucci's own prowling the corridors of Congress advocating a tax break. Well, I know there's a lot of religious discussion going on in this country that has nothing to do with politics. In fact, religion has been giving God a bad name. And I just thought it would be a good idea if I could recreate on television what I heard there in Burt Vysotsky's seminar room.
In talking about the importance of Bible stories and of stories in general, you quote the Baal Shem Tov, a story that Elie Wiesel tells, that the Baal Shem Tov told. Would you tell that story?
Well, it's a story that's too long for me to tell, actually, Terry. It's the story of the rabbi who... The point of the story is that they keep telling these old stories because in telling them they tie themselves to the past. They keep the memory alive. The Jews have a wonderful notion that in remembrance is the secret of redemption, and that by listening and by recounting and retelling these stories of God's purpose in history and the response of the Jewish people, every generation is awakened to the necessity of carrying on that tradition and to the hope that comes from knowing that in the past the word has never died out, never disappeared, that it's always a force in the lives of people once they have unearthed it, brought it back, confronted it, and recounted it and shared it. And that's what's so important about these stories that Vysotsky was saying, for example, that the story comes alive when you actually hear other people talk about it. Each of us is our own interpreter of the sacred text. And so I have something to learn from you because your own experience with that text is so different from mine. And when we talk about them together, communally, together, as Burt Vysotsky says, we're teaching each other and learning from each other. And that's certainly what I heard at his seminar, and that's certainly what I think happens in our series.
Do you remember a formative experience where you read the Bible and all of a sudden you saw something that you'd never seen before that gave that particular part of the Bible a brand new meaning, a meaning that no one had ever showed to you before, something you found for yourself that maybe even contradicted what you were brought up thinking it was supposed to mean?
Well, of course, the story of Jacob was a very familiar one to me when I was growing up and when I was in graduate school, but it was taken as the story and told as the story of the founding of Israel. Jacob, who after that dark ordeal of the night in which he wrestled with the stranger there by the river, was came out the next day with a new name, Israel. And this was told as the historical, genealogical account of the origins of Israel. And that's how it was told to me. Much, much later, of course, after I had lost my own brother at the age of 39, and I was 32, and some matters were left unresolved between us, and after I'd had traumas in my own life, I realized just how much like Jacob all of us are, but me in particular, that I've wrestled in the night with my own demons, with my own fantasies, with my own failures, with my own images, there's a hearty discussion in the series about who exactly was Jacob wrestling with. Was he wrestling with God? Was he wrestling with an angel? Was he wrestling with his darker self? Was he wrestling with the image of his brother, who at that very moment, remember, Jacob had wronged his brother, Esau. And at that very moment, Jacob knew that Esau was on his way to greet him. And was he going to greet him with retribution and revenge over that insult of many years before? Or how? So maybe Jacob was having a premature wrestling match with his brother Esau. But whatever it was, when Jacob did get up the next day, he was renewed, personally transformed. His brother greeted him, embraced him, and said to him, I have enough. What is yours, let's go in peace. Well, I begin, this was for me a realization that it's okay to have these wrestling matches with God. It's okay to have these wrestling matches with yourself, that much of what you're doing in your dreams and in your own inner confrontations is natural, and that one has to go through these experiences, but one is changed by them. I mean, Jacob left limping. He limped for the rest of his life. Some have said in our discussion groups that this is Israel as well, that Israel went through this transformation and has paid a price for the wrestling and for being chosen of God, has always limped through history, even with the great gifts of these people. So that was a very powerful experience when I read Jacob that way.
Did your brother's death send you back to the Bible to reread the Jacob story?
No. I came across the Jacob story much later than that, 10, 15 years after it.
Do things in your life ever send you to the Bible, or are these just kind of like parallel things that happen?
They're more parallel things. I never go to the Bible for proof text. What we used to say in seminary was the proof of the issue, that if you were having an argument with somebody, you just open the Bible and say, here, see, it says this, I told you so. I never use it that way. I was fortunate to grow up in a Baptist church that was emphasized thinking for yourself, what we call the priesthood of the believer, that you had to read the Bible and wrestle with its meanings, and then bringing to bear the best teaching and the best scholarship, decide for yourself what it means. So I've never been to the Bible as a life raft, as a life jacket, as a pill to pop when I'm feeling down or when I'm uncertain. It's the fact that it's so woven into my whole life, and that I read these stories as mirrors, in a way, of our own individual journeys. That's what gets me about, but the exciting part of going back and talking with these stories with so many people, 38 different people in the course of this series, is that these stories speak to us today because they are so starkly human. The people in Genesis rage at one another. They rage at God. They struggle with temptation. They're jealous. They're grief-stricken. They're patient. They're conniving. They're loving. They're hateful. And the dilemmas they face are ours: sibling rivalry, family violence, infertility and surrogate parenting, parents who play favorites. I mean, I read these stories now more as reflections of the human experience in the light of a believing person than I do reading them for instruction.
You preached for a few years, I think, before entering politics and into
journalism. I wouldn't call it that.
You wouldn't call it a few years, you wouldn't call it preaching, which...
I wouldn't call it preaching. Oh, I was pretty... I think one of the reasons I didn't pursue that is that it never came out quite right. I never felt comfortable doing it. I actually intended to teach, Terry. I wanted to... I had signed up when I finished seminary to do my PhD at the university in American civilization, and I wanted to look at religion as a phenomenon in American life. That's what I intended to do. But in seminary, yes, I went out to small churches on Sundays and inflicted my amateurish wisdom on very patient and loving congregations of mostly farmers and their spouses.
Well, I'm wondering if anybody ever came up to you and asked you for advice about what the Bible had to say about their predicament.
Well, I had a very scary experience that was a turning point also in my life. I was pastoring at a student ministry. I'd go out, my wife and I would go out on weekends, and I was in this small church. There were two sisters there, two spinster sisters. They must have been in their late 60s, and they lived with their brother on a farm not far from this church. And they were there this was only every other week I would go out. They were there. And one Sunday, they asked if they could see me after church. I must have been 20. Not quite 21. I was my second half of my sophomore year at the university. And they said to me that they admitted to me, they confessed to me in Protestant church, but this was a confession that they'd been having incestuous relations with their brother, and they needed help. They were deeply guilt-stricken. They were deeply disturbed by this, and they needed help. And what did I have to tell them? Well, I remember mumbling and fumbling something and saying, you know, let me think about it, and I'll come back to see you. I went immediately that afternoon the next afternoon when I got back to back home, I went to a marvelous man who was a great and generous-souled minister, broad in his faith and learned in his wisdom, and talked to him. He said, Moyers, you've got no business trying to bring the Bible to bear on them. Thank God you didn't do that. I want you to go out to the university and see. And he gave me the name of a leading psychiatrist, psychologist who taught at the University School of Department of Psychology. I went out to see him, and this man said, well, I'll be glad to try to help them. It's a very serious issue. You tell them to call me. Try to get them to come see me. Bring them if they'll come with you. So the next time I went out, I went by to see them and talk to them, and I could tell that if the Bible couldn't help them, if I couldn't help them, then they didn't think psychology and psychiatry could help them. Now, this was back in the 50s when that generation of folk didn't have much use for the new psychological insights of the secular world, and they never followed through. And I realized at that moment that I wasn't equipped to help those people who hungered for some answer that I couldn't give them, for some help that I couldn't give them. So that was an occasion in which it wasn't easy to open the Bible and find something that would give them encouragement.
Well, if you knew then what you know now, would you have pushed even harder for them to see a psychiatrist, or would you have like found something in the Bible that you think might have that you would think would be a little bit helpful, hoping that that would at least set them off in the right direction?
Well,
the right direction. What do I mean here? I mean, obviously, they needed a lot of probably emotional help as well as just advice about how to behave.
I would have gotten them to a medical doctor who they would have trusted. A doctor. I would have talked to the doctor about their situation and then had him take them by the hand and lead them in the next direction. And of course, there are so many more avenues for help today than I knew of in back in the 1950s. So I would have tried a more cautious, careful but loving relationship. And I said to them that I didn't think they should judge themselves harshly until they did get some help that I couldn't provide them. I was trying to get them to move beyond the concept of sin to the concept of a deep problem that could be solved without so much denunciation that they were bringing, self-denunciation that they were inflicting on themselves, because they thought the Bible, you know, condemned and this so harshly. I could have been a much more help to them. It's very, very dangerous to traffic at such an early age in the emotional needs of other people, and that was one of the reasons why I realized that I wasn't fitted for that. Actually, nowadays, you could find churches with counselors, with people whose experience is in psychology and religion, who could have been much more helpful to them than an untrained, wet behind the ears, aspiring theologian out in a country church with very little to go on.
My guest is Bill Moyers. He has a new PBS series and companion book called Genesis, A Living Conversation. The series begins October 16th. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Bill Moyers, and he has a new TV series and companion book called Genesis, A Living Conversation. And it's a series of conversations interpreting the stories within Genesis. I'd like to step back for a moment to your previous TV series, the one you did in 1993 on healing in the mind, which was about the mind's effect on creating illness and also on curing illness. It was a wonderful series. I think it was about a year after that series went on the air that you had bypass surgery, heart bypass.
Yes.
I couldn't help but think, what a way to test what you had learned in the TV series. I really have wondered for a long time if that series affected at all how you handled your own medical care during that period.
It didn't in the beginning, but it did in the end. In the beginning, I was the last person that I would ever have expected of having a blocked artery, where it must have come from all that Texas barbecue and all that ice cream that I loved when I was growing up. But I did one January day in 1994, after I had done the series which aired in 1993 on healing in the mind, the emotions and health. I felt the pressure, and I wound up in the hospital, and ultimately I had a bypass surgery, and I got up too soon and went back to work too soon, accepted too many deadlines, and the symptoms all hit me again. This time I realized that I had to do something more than just let myself, to put myself in the hands of a traditional physician. And I went down to Beth Israel Hospital in New York and signed up for a three-month program sponsored by Dean Ornish, who's one of the leading young cardiologists in the country now. And this was conducted by Dr. Stephen Horowitz, who is the chief of cardiology at Beth Israel Hospital. And I will forget something that Dr. Horowitz said to me. He said, "Moyers, I've never known anyone who has a better intellectual grasp of this whole issue of emotions and health, mind-body. But I've had very few people have had as little experience with it as you have." And of course, that's the issue for so many of us journalists, that we go after these issues professionally and we never appropriate them personally. Well, I went through this program 3 days a week, 4 hours a day, 1 hour of emphasis on guided exercise, the kind of exercise one should do that enables one to achieve certain milestones in the course of it, not just to do it for the doing of it, an hour on group sessions, group therapy. You're in that room with 20, 22 other people. You don't know any of them. They know you because you're on television, and so that is an immediate early impediment to discussion. I said, "What am I doing in here? I've got my own experience to deal with." And yet, over the course of actually 4 months, I learned so much from the housewife who was there, who was suffering from heart disease. I learned so much from the factory foreman from New Jersey who was talking about his experiences. I saw more of myself reflected in their questions and their confessions than I ever would have thought possible. And I came to really care about that group, and they cared about me, and we learned together. The third hour was devoted to meditation and yoga as a way of dealing with the stress in your body. Now, in my series, Healing in the Mind, I had a 90-minute program on the importance of meditation. We had filmed extensively at University of Massachusetts Medical Center, where John Kabat-Zinn uses meditation to help people suffering from chronic pain. I knew all about it intellectually. I knew all about it as empirically. But experientially, existentially, I had not put myself into it. Well, in this hour, under a wonderful woman who truly has a way of bringing you to focus, to be mindful of the present moment, of getting you in your own inner world through contemplation and meditation. She did more for me in those 4 months than anyone ever has. And so I came to use meditation regularly. Even though I'm out now traveling the country, and every afternoon I've saved time for myself. I'll go back to the hotel room and I'll put on one of her tapes or the tapes I got from Herb Benson at the Deaconess Hospital in Boston. He was the one who introduced this whole idea of guided relaxation. And in 45 or 50 minutes there in the hotel in the afternoon, by meditation and contemplative yoga, I really renew myself and am able to spend the next 6 or 8 hours as if it were a new day. It's really different from looking at it as an observer and putting it to practice in your own life.
Bill Moyers, he'll be back with us in the second half of our show. His new PBS series begins Wednesday, October 16th. His companion book is called Genesis, A Living Conversation. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Bill Moyers. He has a new PBS series and a companion book, both called Genesis, A Living Conversation. When we left off, we were talking about his heart bypass surgery in 1994, a year after the broadcast of his PBS series, Healing and the Mind. What was it like for you when you were in the hospital recovering from the bypass, and here you were, Bill Moyers, Mr. Healing and the Mind, recovering in the hospital? You must have felt like quite the specimen.
I did, but the first thing that happened to me was really a transcendent experience. I'd been out for, I guess, in intensive care and recovery for about 48 to 60 hours. And when the surgery was on Tuesday morning, I came to on Thursday at midnight back in my room, and the night nurse had fallen asleep over in the corner of the room. She'd gone to sleep with the television set still on, and Channel 13, the public television station in New York, at midnight that night was repeating what the previous Sunday had been a live performance of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. Now, I love Beethoven and Bach and Brahms, and I'd listened to this particular symphony all of my adult life, but I had only listened to it. I had never experienced it. And when I woke up from this long life in this long passage in the netherworld, in slumber or wherever one is under the influence of anesthesia, that was on. And for the first time in my life, I experienced the music. The music was in me. I was the music. I don't know how else to say it except that there was a coupling there of that music and my consciousness in a way that was exuberant, that was exhilarating, that was in itself very healing. And with that, I was back in the real world, but I was back in the real world in a way I had never encountered it or experienced it before. So that put a different glow around my recovery, and I suddenly was able to understand all that I had learned intellectually in the producing and reporting of Healing in the Mind. And I had wonderful conversations with a host of doctors at Mount Sinai Hospital and nurses and therapists. Most of the therapists in particular, the occupational therapists, had seen the series Healing in the Mind. And, of course, it had kind of legitimated what they do. And here they had the living specimen. And we had marvelous conversations there. They thought I knew more about it than I did, because they thought that I had done the series because I had lived the life, walked the walk. I hadn't. I did the series because I was curious about this phenomenon.
I keep thinking about what a really fortunate experience it was to re-enter consciousness with Beethoven playing in your room.
One of those moments of gift, you know, that just happens to be a gift of life, a circumstance that turns into an illumination.
With the TV on, hey, it could have been Wheel of Fortune, you know?
And then I'd be a rich man today.
You know, when you have bypass, they virtually kill you and then bring you back to life.
Yeah, and they open up your chest.
Yeah, it's just a remarkable procedure. And from my experience watching people who've been through it, you're not yourself for a while. I mean, you're physically weak. Some people don't have their memory back for a few days or even longer than that. A lot of people have a period of depression early on in their recovery. Sometimes that depression lasts even longer. Did you go through a period of feeling not quite yourself and wondering if you'd ever be yourself again?
I went through a period that was a strange period. I'd never suffered depression, but I felt off balance. I felt that something had happened that I couldn't identify. Somebody had taken something out of me that I couldn't name, designate. That it was almost as if my foot was a few inches shorter than it had been, or my gyroscope inside was out of tune, out of whack. I don't know what it was. It was one of those strange feelings, like waking up from a dream and wondering if it had been a dream or what. I made a foolish mistake. I did take out for 3 months. I had the surgery in May, but the 17th of September, May, June, July, August, 4 months later, I was filming 8 interviews a day at the Dodge Poetry Festival in New Jersey for an upcoming series on Language of Life, a series about poetry. And there I was, working from early in the morning until late in the evening. Even as I was doing it, I knew it wasn't quite right. I didn't quite connect the way I had connected before when I was talking to people. I did not even know to what to ascribe it. But something I was off balance. It was actually a full year and more after the surgery, and after I went through this program at Beth Israel, the Dean Ornish program, that I really began to feel that both feet were back on the ground, that I was back in the world as I should be, and that I knew where I was and what I was doing.
I just find it so interesting that so much of your work has been related to religion. Religion is from a sociological, from a political, from a spiritual dimension, and more recently, your work, some of it has been about health, and those things just had to be so present with you during your period of recovery. You know, Bible stories. We think about that a lot.
No, I didn't. I really didn't. I read lots of poetry and had poetry read to me. I love nonfiction. I read Kathleen Norris's Dakota. Mm-hmm. I read a lot of literature in which people like me are actually exploring the deeper harbors of life, one can say. But no, I didn't read the Bible per se. I love the Psalms, and I did read the Psalms. But it's interesting, Terry. I do more traditional journalism than I do covering religious stories. I do investigative documentaries with Frontline. But you're right about
the point. You keep coming back to this.
Yeah, and I keep coming, and that gets the stories I do about healing in the mind, and with Joseph Campbell, the Power Myth, and Genesis, and this year's series with Houston Smith on the Wisdom of Faith. They get so much more intense a response than anything else I do. I don't know why that is, except that, you know, for many millions of people, religion is a subjective reality. Faith matters. It affects their behavior. And even if they're unchurched people, even if they're people moving beyond the bounds of orthodoxy, they are people searching for some meaning in life, some deeper experience in life, even searching for some union with the transcendent reality. And I find this a phenomenon all across this country today, that people are trying to compose their own inner response to a chaotic world, and that they're turning to a variety of different sources. Some people find that consolation, that hope, and that information in beyond Orthodox religion. Some people move back to Orthodox religion. I think baby boomers are doing this to a considerable degree, turning back to these familiar texts to see what was unfamiliar when they first read them and can be appropriated today. There is something about this that, you know, there's a wonderful line in James Weldon Johnson's epic poem, Green Pastures, where Gabriel says, "Everything that's tied down is coming loose." And that pretty well sums up the modern world. I think it's probably always been true. One of my friends told me once that when Adam and Eve left the Garden of Eden, Adam turned to Eve and said, "My dear, we live in an age of transition." I think that's true of every time, but this time seems to be much more intense, much more frequent and happening every day. Something's different, and people are groping for some anchors, for some grounding, and they're having to compose their own.
Bill Moyers, I really want to thank you for talking with us.
My pleasure, Terry.
Bill Moyers has a new PBS series and companion book called Genesis, A Living Conversation. The series begins Wednesday, October 16th, and continues over the next 9 consecutive Sundays. This is Fresh Air.